This week, some things are grinding Bill Hosler's gears. What could those things be? Women Freemasons? Points in or out? Green beans? Alcohol in lodge? You'll have to listen to find out. Then we'll ask an age-old question. Who the heck was Enoch? And what does it mean when he says that he walked with God? Kristen Wilson Slack's got an excellent post on this. She explores the various facets of what we know about Enoch, where we can read more, and she also discusses the origin of Enochian. Ed Kelly? John D. anybody? Well, if you don't know, you will. All this and more coming right up. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 523. First of all, I want to thank the contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Without you, we cannot make this show, and I want to thank you sincerely from the bottom of my heart. I try to have an attitude of gratitude all year long, but in addition, have a special focus on this around the holiday seasons. Thanksgiving just passed. I hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving for those of you in the United States, or if anybody else celebrated it on that same day. I hope it was a great holiday for you and that you were able to reflect on the things you're thankful for. Of course, the things I'm thankful for are my wife, my kids, my family, my dogs, and their spiritual, anatomical, and mental health. I'm also thankful for those three things of my own as well, my own spiritual, anatomical, and mental health. And I'm very thankful to have those. I'm thankful to have the abundance of love and support, that I have a steady paycheck. All of these things I'm very thankful for. And so I hope you are thankful for your, quote-unquote, manifold blessings that you have as well. If you are curious on how you can help this program, you can head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, check out the number of ways that you can help support us there, and if you'd like to get a little something for your money, then consider the limited edition shop. Just click on the shop at the top. We've got our producer's pin. I think I just sold our last Craftsman Plus journal and pen, but of course we have Max Heindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation for sale. We have the Master's Word Annotated Edition. We've got How to Charter a Lodge and the Time-Tested and Brother-Approved It's Business Time. I've also got a few MasonicCon Chicago Limited items left. And in the news, I just wanted to mention that it is a bummer. I know a lot of you are looking forward to this. However, I do have to postpone the initiation of Plato. We were all set to go live and do the performance for you all on December 17th. However, I have a job to do that very evening, which kind of came up last minute. So, with that said, we are looking at a January date to do this, and I know it will be worth the wait. What else in the news? Well, how about Double Eagle Con 2021, December 18th? That is going to be the date to remember. On that day, we are going to have Brother Michael Pohl, Joseph Wages, Roberto Sanchez, Steve Harrison, Chuck Dunning, Brent Morris, Bob Davis, Darren Laners, and Jeffrey Croteau are all going to be in attendance. Only two of them are virtually speaking. That will be Michael Pohl and, I believe, Jeffrey Croteau. They will be virtually attending, but everybody else will be there in person for this awesome day of Masonic education. You can get your tickets to this if you head to tinyurl.com/DoubleEagleCon2021. And I'll have a link to these in the show notes to check out the event. You can read a little bit about the presenters. And if you follow the Valley of Chicago on social media, you will see the topics of choice. We have covered that in the past, and in some of the episodes, we've talked about the talks that are coming, and I think you'll all agree that they are fantastic and mind-expanding. I hope you enjoy. I hope to see you there on the 18th. I'll be there most of the day, so I am looking forward to the event. Now, the first piece I wanted to read for you today comes from Brother Bill Hosler. Now, it's been a while since I've read something from Brother Bill. He's busy all the time with all kinds of awesome Masonic stuff and traveling around. You know, he had gotten over COVID recently. He was on a trip to Alaska. Just amazing. And if you love Bill, you know, you can obviously check him out on the podcast that he helps with. And he's a co-host on, which is the Meet, Act, and Part podcast, which is hosted by, of course, Bill, Darren Lehners, and brother Greg Knott. If you haven't checked that podcast out yet, highly recommend you do so and consider supporting their efforts. I'll have a link back to their podcast as well. But let's take a look at this great piece that brother Bill put together. I want to say before I jump into this one, let's read through it and try to stay objective. Here we go. This is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, by brother Bill Hosler. Growing up, I thought it was just my dysfunctional family. Every now and then, I or my brother or my sister, or two of us in a conspiracy against the other, would end up doing something that would start a large argument among the Hosler children. Screaming and name-calling ensued, and eventually something would end up getting broken because the argument would become physical. At this point, my mom would often join the chorus of loud voices with her famous, "This is why we can't have nice things," cry. I think this was an unspoken code between us siblings that we had better knock it off, or the next step would be my father walking into the room like Chuck Norris, belt in hand, to bring peace and quiet back to his kingdom. Dad wasn't concerned about justice. He just wanted quiet so he could hear his television program again. It wasn't until I grew up, until I discovered that Mom's famous chant was something every mother says. Maybe it is taught at a mother's school right before the "if your friends jumped off a bridge, you would jump too" nonsense. Not long ago, I was on a flight from Anchorage, Alaska to Oklahoma City. The flight was long and cramped. I was bored, so I decided to find something to pass the time. While catching up with Twitter, I saw a tweet, and I began to smile. I knew I shouldn't do it, but the devil sitting on my shoulder talked me into it. Maybe the little angel who should have been on the other shoulder was detained by the TSA, but he was definitely not on the job. The tweet was posted from the account of the United Grand Lodge of England. The photo celebrates an open house that was held at the Grand Temple in London. Pictured in the photograph were Dr. David Staples, Grand Secretary of the United Grand Lodge of England, and the Grand Secretary of the Women's Freemason Grand Lodge in the UK. The tweet read, quote, "The Grand Secretary Central! Exclamation point. The Grand Secretaries of both the United Grand Lodge of England and Freemasonry for Women are here at Freemasons Hall for Open House London today to answer any questions you may have about Freemasonry for both men and women." I could almost feel the moderators of the Winding Stairs Facebook group cringe as I posted the photo. I knew what was about to happen. But since I am a moderator in the group myself, with a lot of time on my hands, I thought I could keep the oncoming dumpster fire down to a smoldering campfire. Before the flight attendants passed out the first package of peanuts, the posts started. Some, from the He-Man Women Haters branch of Freemasonry, who like to throw the word clandestine around, and remind everyone they will never forget their obligations by never sitting in a lodge room with women, and the usual posts that go with any picture of a person wearing an apron in a skirt. Then the other side was defending the tweet. How we need to get more progressive, like our English brethren, I thought to myself. However, my favorite comments are from the brethren who have no clue and say, quote, "Well, if women want to be Masons, they can join the Eastern Star." Like, it's the same thing. They also decide to throw a few smibs into the mix for absolutely no reason, and I saw things begin to slowly devolve. As the conversation progressed, the dialogue started to become un-Masonic. The name-calling began. Some actual threats were made. I began to think this whole thing had gone too far. Sadly for the group and for Freemasonry, I had to ban some members of the group for their conduct. In a way, I am not sorry because we were able to do what should have been done at their lodge's west gate. If a man is going to threaten, harass, or generally treat a Masonic brother in such a manner, he doesn't deserve to be a member of the Winding Stairs group, or the fraternity itself. I can't do anything about the latter, but I have the power to keep the integrity of the former. The saddest part of this whole scene to me is all of the snarling and gnashing was completely unnecessary. If someone would do a bit of easy research beforehand instead of going off half-cocked, this wouldn't be a thing at all. The He-Man Women Haters continually say that the United Grand Lodge of England is rubbing shoulders with a clandestine organization that they have recognized them as Freemasons. Allow me to let you in on a little secret. They haven't. The United Grand Lodge of England's relationship with the two female Grand Lodges in the United Kingdom is like dealing with the Mafia. It's business, not personal. The ladies help the Grand Lodge at fundraising for charity, and they rent the building for their grand communication. There is no fraternal visitation between the groups. In no way does the male Grand Lodge consider themselves to be in amity with either of the feminine organizations. In simple terms, it's like they are saying, "You ladies want to be Masons? Cool, no skin off our noses, have fun." They each do their own thing, and everyone is happy. You can read more about it at the links provided. Another one of these misunderstood topics, which is sure to destroy Freemasonry as we know it, is the dreaded Chamber of Reflection. Basically, the Chamber of Reflection is a room with no windows, usually painted black. Before a petitioner is allowed to progress to the Entered Apprentice degree, he is placed in the room of complete darkness. He is given a match and instructed to light the candle before him. Once the candle is lit, he sees several objects before him on a table with a paper and pen. After some time of thinking about the step he is about to take and whether he wishes to progress, he answers the questions on the paper. If the petitioner answers correctly, he is allowed to continue to the degree work. The process is designed to make him really think about it if he is truly serious about gaining membership and if he is truly willing to devote himself to a lifetime of work that lays before him. The process isn't that uncommon. Many Grand Lodges around the world have this as part of their ritual, and even the Knights Templar here in the United States uses their degree work. The funny thing is that nearly every time a group of Masons suggests they add this to their lodge ritual, the eyes of several brethren will bug out and find it hard to breathe. Without understanding the reasoning for the room or the fact that it is used the world over, a knee will automatically jerk up and the brother whose face has now reddened and is close to hyperventilating will be strictly against it, threatening to call the Grand Lodge, then the Grand Master, and then the Grand Architect of the Universe, or any other grand which can keep his lodge from falling down the rabbit hole of clandestine Freemasonry. I heard a tale about one brother who, while in lodge, decided to jump up and compare the chamber as a place to give a candidate a hallucinogenic drug and perform Satan worship. I hope that sound I hear is your eyes rolling from here. As silly as it sounds, it is such things that keep our numbers from growing and our retention numbers from free-falling. Even sillier, I wonder how many of these brethren whose aprons end up in a wad sat in a similar room before they became Sir Knights of the KT, or the Knight Templar. Probably the same number of people who had zero problems drinking libations with real wine during the Templar ceremonies, but object to having alcohol inside a Masonic temple. This brings me to the next item on my rant list, Demon Rum. This may shock none of you, but Grand Lodge Freemasonry began in rooms above taverns. I'll wait for you all to regain your composure. In fact, throughout the 18th century and much of the 19th century, it was a commonplace thing to have beer, ale, and hard liquor to be consumed before and after lodge meetings. Wine was also served at dinner and feasts. It wasn't until the mid to late 19th century when the temperance zealots began their assault on American society. Churches became involved in the movement, and eventually legislation began to come before Grand Lodges asking for the complete prohibition of alcohol within the walls of Masonic temples. It has been my own theory for years. This was brought on by brothers whose wives were members of the Anti-Saloon League or other such groups. Eventually, most of our Grand Lodges became as dry as one of our business meetings. If you broach the subject of repealing these laws to one of the stalwarts of Masonic tradition, they will almost always parrot the exact same arguments against it. I know this because I have heard these feeble arguments many times in Grand Lodge discussions. Excuses such as, "What if a brother drinks too much and gets pulled over on the way home from lodge? What about our brothers with issues with alcoholism? This would be terrible. The public would drive by our buildings and see drunken Masons pass out on the sidewalk in front of our building." These may sound silly, but they work in getting the old guard to vote no to allow us to move forward. First of all, if we all follow the teachings of Freemasonry like we say we do, we will counsel a good brother and keep him from turning refreshment into intemperance or excess. If by chance he were to drink a bit too much, I would hope a fellow brother would drive this brother home and ensure he gets inside okay. I think I may remember something of an obligation for that sort of thing. I don't know about your Grand Lodge, but my mother Grand Lodge actually has rules against allowing felons, addicts, and alcoholics into the craft. However, the only one people seem to dwell on is the felon one. So the quote-unquote brother with drinking issues should be a non-starter to begin with, assuming you followed the letter of the Masonic law like you want to do and all things you are against. The one that really gets my goat, pun intended, is the idea of drunken Masons passed out in front of the building. Tell me, how many times have you seen those same drunken Masons passed out in front of a shrine temple? Seems to me, if a brother is going to drink himself silly in front of one Masonic edifice, a noble would do the same thing in front of another building. And since the United States is one of the few, if not the only Masonic country to have a prohibition against alcohol, I'm sure drunken Masons must be a worldwide phenomenon, right? If it is, I haven't heard about it in my nearly two decades as a Mason. There are so many things in the craft we tend to dismiss or decide about with a knee-jerk reaction. It's almost like we're allowing our fraternity to die an unnecessary death because an unruly mob carrying torches wish it to be governed by superstition and legend instead of science and facts. I bet if we were to sit down and make a list, many of Freemasonry's hot-button topics could be put to bed if both sides actually knew the facts and made a plan on the subject instead of believing something told him, based on urban legend or what a past master believed it to be 60 years ago. Even if they don't agree, they can at least have an intelligent discussion and perhaps come to some agreeable solution. Like so many things in Freemasonry and in life itself, a little research on the subject will help you sound more intelligent, but will also provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision or opinion. Who knows? Knowing more about the craft besides how to hold a rod during degree work or that George Washington and John Wayne were members might even enhance your love of the fraternity. It might even allow people who were ignorant on a subject to discover that they might actually agree on a topic if they knew the facts. I understand that not everyone is a Masonic nerd like I am. They don't spend hours researching Masonic topics and history. They have actual lives with jobs and families. They go to the lodge a few nights a month, they study the ritual and floor work, and if they have a question, they might ask a past master who, sadly, after nearly a century without Masonic education and lodge, is probably as clueless as the brother is. I can't think of another environment or in no other group where someone can argue an opinion with zero facts and not have their argument called into question with a demand that the person produce evidence in order to be believed. Except on social media, especially when talking about these subjects, forbidden for us to discuss in lodge, but that's a different article. Brethren, I know this is a lot to ask, but if we really want to make our fraternity relevant again, we must actually embrace the forbidden Masonic C word. That word is change. For those of you who have tried to repress it from your memory, the various generations of members must learn to work together and accept that both sides may have some ideas that have value. In other writings, I have laid out what I believe a lodge can do to bring this about and be successful. The only things preventing them are open minds and a willingness to try new things. I think these things will bring actual harmony to a lodge instead of appeasing one side of an argument over another. This all really makes me wonder. I wonder if my brother, sister, and I would have actually gotten along and worked together instead of constantly arguing and fighting, and if my mom could have actually had nice things. Worshipful Brother Bill Hosler. Well, there you have this really cool piece from Bill that addresses several issues of the fraternity, most of the hot-button issues we see on social media and the like. And I have to say, you know, these issues, I used to hop in and type, be a little keyboard warrior all the time. And really, these days, I try to stay out of it as much as possible because I think I've said my piece a number of times. And if my ideas didn't get any traction the last time, you kind of get tired of posting the same things. Maybe most of our keyboard warriors out there with Freemasonry and have some, you know, great research and facts have got some, like a great repository of responses that are canned that we can just copy and paste right into the arguments themselves and move on like some sort of flashbang, right? You throw it into the chat, all right, I'm gone, and you disappear forever. You showed up, you dropped some knowledge, and you left. For our Craftsman Plus out there, I'd love to know, what is your Masonic hot button issue? What's the thing that consistently jumps out at you whenever you get on social media or in your lodge, for that matter, that people always have to bring up and that you have to constantly hear the bickering about? Is it which way to wear your ring? Is it the women in Masonry? Is it felon charges? Is it drinking? What is the hot button issue that you face on a monthly basis, or maybe even more often. All right, next up, I would love to get into a little bit of mystery here. And I'm picking up this piece from the philosophicalsociety.org. I'll have a link back to this article in the show notes, but it comes from Kristen Wilson Slack, who is a member and a part of the Craftsman Plus group as well. So if you've got some thoughts on her writing, then by all means, you could tag her in a post and she might get back to you. Well, I'm not sure. But in any case, she wrote this really cool piece called Who Was Enoch? What Happened When He Walked with God? So there's some background. You know, Enoch is typically associated with the vaults, with the cube of creation, with the tetragrammaton, the man who never died, who is called up to walk with God. And so this is pretty interesting and quite mysterious. You've heard the name mentioned on Ancient Aliens and other cool shows like that. But let's hear what Kristen Wilson Slack has to say. She wrote this again December 14th, 2018, just a few years ago. She opens with a quote from Genesis 5, 21-24. Enoch was son of Jared and fathered Methuselah. The text of the book of Genesis says Enoch lived 365 years before he was taken by God. The text reads that Enoch, quote-unquote, walked with God and he was no more, for God took him. This is what I learned about Enoch early on in my Bible as Literature class in high school. I was intrigued, and the name of Enoch stayed with me ever since. Walking with God took on so many different meanings. He was transported to heaven, and his physical body never died, or that he died painlessly, or that he died painlessly because of his righteousness, were two classical interpretations. As I've learned, there are other views of who and what Enoch might be. In Judeo-Christian circles, he is considered the scribe of judgment. He's considered the author of the Book of Enoch, an apocryphal work, which was followed by the Second Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch is considered by the Western Christian Church as non-canonical, or non-inspired, also known as revealed works. Some Orthodox sects see it as canonical, and most scholars of Judeo-Christian literature find it of either historical or theological value. The Book of Enoch is considered to be, technically, five independent pieces of work written between 300 BCE and 100 CE. The five independent pieces are seen as, with Wikipedia links, the Book of the Watchers, the Astronomical Book, Book of Dream Visions, and Epistle of Enoch. These books talk about first the fall of the angels, who were alleged to have fathered the Nephilim, as described in Genesis. The rest of the books are writings about Enoch's revelations about and travels to heaven, either via visions or dreams. Some of the concepts discussed in these books are interesting and could have been controversial to the first Christian church leaders. The books contain histories of the fallen angels and their interaction with humankind. Enoch's travels through what might be considered the underworld and heaven, a discussion about the Tree of Life, who the seven archangels were, parables on living, descriptions of heavenly bodies and their movements, and much more. Fragments of the Book of Enoch can be found in other writings of the Old and New Testaments, other apocryphal works, and in the Quran. The Second Book of Enoch is also known as the Secrets of Enoch, and tells the story of how Enoch was transported to and through the heavens, and further relates tales of the War of the Angels. There is a Third Book of Enoch, which exists, and the Book of Giants, which is attributed to the same time period and relating to the same topics. So Enoch has a lot of interesting things going on with him, his life and his afterlife, so much so that it has inspired many and decidedly different tangents to esoteric teachings. We know that Enoch, or Idris, as he is known in the Quran, was known to have been lifted up to heaven, as noted in the Christian Bible. The Quran contains two references to Idris. In Surah Al-Anbiya, the Prophets, verse number 85, and in Surah Maryam, Mary, verse 56 through 57. From the Prophets, 21:85, quote, "And the same blessing was bestowed upon Ismail, and Idris, and Zulkifl, because they all practiced fortitude," end quote. Mary, 19:56 through 57, quote, "And I remember Idris in the book. He was indeed very truthful, a prophet, and we lifted him to a lofty station." End quote. Some Jewish scholars think that Enoch became the head of the angelic host, Metatron. Edgar Cayce, a Christian fundamentalist and traveler to the realms of the dead, has a very elaborate reincarnation lineage of Jesus Christ, of which Enoch was one incarnation. To Cayce, Enoch was also Hermes, or Thoth, Jehuti, the priest Joshua, and a few other incarnations. While this is interesting, we have not addressed the idea of Enochian. What is it? Enter John Dee and Edward Kelly, a.k.a. Talbot. Much has been written about John Dee, and much of it is dismissive. However, he was an extremely learned man with a fervent desire to heal the rifts between the Catholic Church and the Church of England and the Protestant sects in mainland Europe. He was a devout man, and while we might understand how this can all work together, he was a scientist, alchemist, and occultist. In his desire to mend the religious wounds of the time, he sought to discover the original language, the language of God and angels. In doing so, he felt that he could bring about the unification of humanity. Not being a medium or a scryer himself, he turned to both his son, Arthur Dee, and eventually to Edward Kelly, a younger alchemist and spirit medium. For 8 tumultuous and energetic years, they worked together with Edward, relating the angelic language to John Dee through a series of seances and spirit conferences. Dee's writings have been republished by the web archives and by some publishing houses. Copies also exist in the British Library. The language that Dee and Kelly uncovered or created, some debate exists, of course, was called by Dee the angelic or Adamic language, as it was the supposed language that God used to create the universe, that Adam learned from God, and what Adam used to name all living things. The idea of an antediluvian singular language was very popular at the time of the Western world, and seeking it was one of Dee's highest priorities. He was a mathematician, philosopher, astronomer, cartographer, and navigator. Even though he is known more for his magical leanings, he was an extremely well-educated man. He was also a follower of Neoplatonic ideals. If one reads some of Dee's journals or diaries of this work, one can see some of the occult influences that came into Freemasonry at a later time and are evident in several Masonic rituals, especially in the English Rites and Scottish Rites higher degrees. Elias Ashmole, who was the first to document the date of his speculative initiation, followed Kelly's and Dee's work closely. In fact, he reproduced some of Kelly's documents and created a biography of John Dee. Ashmole's notation of his speculative initiation has undergone a fair amount of scrutiny, which will not be replicated here. He seemed to have an influence with many people who were swirling around the speculative Masonic world. It's hard to believe that someone of Ashmore's experience in the sciences and esoteric studies could not have influenced an organization he was a member of for decades. He's well known for having written the Institution, Laws, and Ceremonies of the Order of the Garter in 1672, as well as being a member of the Royal Society. The author in the book noted below that Ashmole was a joiner, and joining a society of Freemasons seemed to be the thing to do at the time in England. It is somewhat apparent that as his time as a Freemason went on, he did exert further influence. An excellent book to read about this time period, and about John Dee, Kelly, and Ashmole, is The Golden Builders by Thomas Churton. It is a deeper historical account of these persons than can be given here. I think we may safely say that John Dee and Edward Kelly put the Enoch in Enochian, which begs deeper insight into who Enoch was and why he went with God. Another excellent book is The Book of Enoch by Wiser Books and author R.H. Charles. The most recent publication is 2003. We'll close with this small excerpt from that book. 103:2. Quote, "I know a mystery, and I have read the heavenly tablets, and have seen the holy books." Kristen Wilson Slack. So in the time period that we live in, where we are able to objectively look at the various different mystery traditions, religious and philosophies and mythologies that exist, I'm curious. We often have archetypes of the character of Enoch, and we mentioned here that perhaps Cayce thought he was Thoth or Hermes or these kinds of ideas, but I am curious on your thoughts. Is the story of Enoch walking with God, How would you interpret the story of Enoch in just a few sentences? Was he a simple man who heard the word of God and was called up, not unlike perhaps a Buddha, not unlike a man who has reached a level of existence that ascends to heaven, like an apotheosis of a sorts? But that is what I'm curious about. I find the topic of Enoch very interesting. And as Kristen has pointed out within this text, there's a lot of controversy around not so much John Dee, but certainly Edward Kelly and his quote-unquote magical language and his ability to be a medium of sorts. Something else about this piece that stands out, I think, that we can do some further kind of esoteric research on is the idea of the Adamic language. I've often thought about a universal language as something that perhaps might not even be communicable. It may not be words, or maybe it is, and maybe it's the language, you know, before the fall of Babel. I've also heard this language called the language of the birds.
All right, let's move now into our contemplative practice of drawing one tarot card. Now, if you're just joining us, as the usual disclaimer goes, we're not drawing tarot cards to be divinatory or anything like that. We are drawing a single card from a single deck to take a look at the meaning behind it and reflect on what that could mean for our own lives. It's a reflection piece. For the last couple weeks, we've been using the Smith-Waite deck, and this week, I chose a different deck to use. We're going to use the Revised Tarot with new art from J.A. Knapp, and the deck is the Manly P. Hall deck. This particular deck I picked up at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles, California. I think the main campus there is closed, but I think the bookshop is still open. I think. You'd want to call to find out. A fantastic bookstore and a fantastic group of people who work there, and the librarian and everybody else who works there is really, really awesome. So anyway, as I shuffle these cards for us. We got two more shuffles to go. If you're asking, is there some number of traditional number of shuffles that you should do? Maybe there is. But that's not what I'm doing. I simply cut the deck into two and shuffle each a couple times, and then I put them together just so I get a good mix. We're using a full deck, and what we'll do is I'll go ahead and draw the card here in just a second. And then I'll talk about what the card means objectively, in the most broad sense, in a reflective kind of way. And then I'll give you the meaning based from Manly P. Hall's own writings. And we'll wrap it up with a question that we can contemplate and perhaps share our answers in the Craftsman Plus or Facebook, or maybe you just want to journal about it or just think about it or not at all. Take it or leave it. But here we go. Let's see what we get. Wow, alright, so I got key 21/22. Now that's kind of weird, usually that's not like that, but here in Manly P. Hall's deck, he combines keys 21 and 22. This is the World card. Amazingly, I have drawn for the third or fourth week in a row a Major Arcana card. This is highly unusual considering the fact that there are only a certain number of Major Arcana cards versus the plethora of Minor Arcana. It's like court cards versus number cards in a regular deck of playing cards. So, the World card. And without jumping too far ahead, I'll tell you this. I drew it in the face-up way, so it's not inverted, it's not reversed. Typically, the World card is just numbered number 21. Now, drawn upright, it means completion, integration, accomplishment, and can even represent travel. The card itself, I'll post a picture of, it usually has a bear woman wrapped in a cloth that's either crimson or purple, and she's dancing inside of a wreath. Symbolically, it's likely a laurel wreath, and she's usually looking to one side or the other, which represents her checking the past. But her body has forward momentum with her right foot moving forward, so it's almost as if she's remembering the past as she moves forward. She's got two batons or wands in her hands. Now, they could be wands, they could be batons. Sometimes they're in two different hands, but in the Manly P. Hall deck, she holds them both in her left hand. And this is kind of a symbol of creationism. She's accomplished. That's why she doesn't have just one. She has two. She knows the value of her own creative potential. The World card is also usually surrounded by the Tetramorph. So the man, the eagle, bull, and the lion. This is symbolic of the cyclical nature of time and the world. And the reason why the cyclical nature of the card is there, and the woman is walking through the laurel wreaths, is a representation of continuing cycles. So as she is stepping forward or moving through the wreath, she is ending one period and looking back on it as she's stepping forward into another. So it's like time. So with the Tetramorph, this is similar. With the surrounding Tetramorph, this is really similar to the Wheel of Fortune. In this particular one, these four figures represent those four fixed signs of the zodiac, which is Leo, Taurus, Scorpio, and Aquarius. They're also symbols of the four elements, and the four suits of the tarot, and the four compass points, and the seasons, and the four corners of the universe, quote-unquote. So when the World card, this particular card, is upright, now this is my objective opinion on what this card really comes from. This is not Manly P. Hall's description yet, but what this card gives us is that perhaps we've just achieved something. We've fulfilled something. Whether that is a class that you just finished, or you finished a big project at work, or you just got closure for something. The card itself could represent things like major events, births of a child, like the completion of 9 months of gestation, or it could be graduation, or getting married, or maybe you've always dreamt of becoming an actor and you finally got your first part. The card itself is asking you to think about or reflect on how you got to this achievement. How did you organize your thoughts and your actions in order to accomplish the goal? Now, in masonry, maybe you just got your third degree proficiency. How did you do it? Not just by sitting there and memorizing, but think about the thought processes you had in holding yourself accountable for exactly how you completed this goal. Now, you might be thinking, RJ, I don't have any idea of anything I've accomplished recently. Well, then take one step back. Maybe this card means you're very close to accomplishing something. But in most cases, I think we can all think about something. It doesn't even have to be what you would consider major, right? Because we have our own subjective opinion on goals and aspirations. But maybe that goal is as simple as 90 days sober. What an accomplishment, right? And so if you cannot think of something that you have accomplished, maybe then the World card is telling you, hey, don't lose sight and keep it up. Now, at the beginning of this particular explanation, I did mention that it could even relate to travel. So it could relate to travel, and since it's the World card, we're talking about big-time travel. Thousands of miles, maybe like a really long cruise, or maybe you're going to travel abroad, extended periods. So to quote one of my favorite books on the tarot, the World card in this sense could reinforce our ideas of universal understanding, global awareness, and a new appreciation for people and cultures from across the world. It's probably my favorite part about the card in itself. Now, that's a really objective and my personal thoughts on the tarot on this card. But this is from the Manly P. Hall deck. And so, let me go ahead and just read to you what Hall says in his little white book. Key 21/22, Le Monde, the world. Hebrew letter Tau or Tav, cross sign. Le Monde, the world, portrays a female figure draped with a scarf which the wind blows into the form of a Hebrew letter Kaf. Her left hand holds two wands, and her left leg crosses behind the right. Her body forms an emblematic cross representing the perpetual dance of the universe. The central figure is surrounded by a wreath in the form of a vesica Pisces. The cherubim of Ezekiel's vision occupy the corners of the card. The tarot is called the microcosm and the macrocosm because in it are summed up every agency contributing to the structure of creation. The woman in the center represents the divine fire in the heart of the great mystery. The wreath in nature, which surrounds the fiery center. The cherubim represent the elements, worlds, forces, and planes issuing out of the divine fiery center of life. The wreath also signifies the crown of the initiate, which is given to those who master the four guardians and enter into the presence of unveiled truth. The shield displays the circle and the cross, or tav, which imitates the squaring of the circle, as well as the archetypal division of the following minor arcana into four elements of fire, water, air, and earth. The world carries both numbers 21 and 22 because this card acts like a gateway, the beginning of a new cycle or whirling, and the portal to the minor arcana. The number 22 reduces to 4, the number of letters of the Holy Tetragrammaton, which provides the spiritual structure for the minor arcana. So that's from Hall's little white book that comes with his tarot deck. Now, something I want to spell out for you here, or give you some insight, rather, is that when I talk objectively about these cards, I talk about them in a very psychological and practical way. And something that you'll notice with some of the thinking and speakers on these cards, as we look through some of the decks, some people are very mystical in the way they talk about the cards, and others are very plain. Now, Manly P. Hall is no stranger to the mystical, so he obviously writes in a very poetic and obtuse occult sense. I don't mean that in any derogatory way. I mean obtuse as in thick or foggy or difficult to understand. And for some, that language is not difficult to understand. It's very simple and meaningful for them. I read those, and I have to read it two times, and I'm usually pretty good, and I get what he's saying. And so for a lot of us, this kind of foggy, mystical talk is difficult to understand. And so I think this is why I always want to lead off with some practical and just very plain language, the way we'll talk about it. And this is the way Paul Case intended the tarot to be understood as well. If you're interested, I think Paul Foster Case does a wonderful job explaining the tarot in a very practical and simple sense, something that nobody else has thought to do. And perhaps this is by design. If you speak vague enough, nobody can ever say you're wrong. Paul Case did not fear this, and that's why he talked in plain language in a way that clearly exhibits his knowledge of exactly what's happening. So that is that. I hope to hear some of your reflections. My question for our Craftsman Plus is, tell me about the project that you have certainly, no matter what it is, what's the project or the accomplishment or the thing that just recently came into fruition for you? We all have something. Something has happened recently that you can call a completeness or an achievement. Tell us about it. Did you finally reach level 100 in solitaire? Did you have a baby? Did you just get the promotion? Did you just graduate Lamaze class? You know, whatever the case might be. I'd love to hear about your most recent accomplishment. And tell us, in the spirit of the card, asking us to reflect not just on the accomplishment, but how we got there, tell us the accomplishment and perhaps the number one piece of advice that you had for yourself in coming to that achievement. But that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed our time together and that you learned a little something, and maybe you can teach us a little something. So if you are so inclined, comment, post, share our episodes with all of your friends and your brothers, and leave some insights when you share the episode out there. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners for assisting us with the production of this show. Again, if you want to know how you can help this program, then head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, see what you can do for Freemasonry by helping to fund Masonic education for anybody who's interested. Currently, our show reaches over 2 million listeners, which is just fantastic. How else can you help? You can subscribe to our YouTube channel, you can like and share our videos. All of these things help us out and actually increase the likelihood that somebody who is learning about Freemasonry might find the WCY podcast. So thanks very much. I'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.